When someone you care about gets sick, really sick, some of the first words that come to your lips may be exactly the opposite of what that person needs to hear. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we'll find out what you should and should not do and say when a loved one is sick. And we'll get some advice on effective communication with the patient, friends and family, and tips on how to cope if you're the patient. I'll talk with clinical psychologist Susan Silk about her ring theory of social support. Dr. Jim Bell, medical director of palliative care and hospice at Unity Point St. Luke's in Cedar Rapids, will also be here, and we want to hear from you. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. When someone you care about becomes seriously ill, you get scared, you worry, you want to help, but some of the easiest things to say to someone who is sick can be the hardest things for them to hear. This hour, we'll find out what you should and should not do when a loved one is sick. And we want to hear your experiences, too. Have you been the one who was sick? How did you cope with some of the things that people said or did around you? Maybe you have a loved one who is ill and you've learned some important lessons about how to help. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. My first guest this hour is clinical psychologist Susan Silk. She has been on both sides of this equation. She's a cancer survivor, and she's been close to others who've struggled with life-threatening diseases. She and her husband co-wrote an article that was published in the LA Times a couple of years ago and went viral called How Not to Say the Wrong Thing, and she's on the line with us today. Hello, Susan.
Hi. Good morning, Charity.
Oh, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you.
And I think the very first paragraph in the article that you wrote for the Los Angeles Times sums up really simply what we're talking about. It says, when Susan had breast cancer, we heard a lot of lame remarks, but our favorite came from one of Susan's colleagues. She needed to visit Susan after the surgery, but Susan didn't feel like having visitors, and she said so. Her colleague's response, this isn't just about you.
and the key word there is colleague. This was another psychologist.
So how did you respond?
Well, the me that's sitting here today would have been up for a fight about it. But at that point, I was feeling a little vulnerable, and we just dealt with it by avoidance.
You also used another example of just the wrong thing to say at the wrong time in that article about a time when a friend of you and your husband, Katie, had a brain aneurysm. Can you tell me what happened there?
Oh, that was the saddest situation. And that's a really good example, because the situation with the person who said that to me, that's just so outside. I mean, it's really hard to imagine somebody saying that. I mean, that's a pretty self-centered, pretty, you know, narcissistic individual. And it's maybe something we would think, but hardly anybody would say this.
Right.
But in the other example, it's something that I think we all can imagine saying without meaning to hurt anyone's feelings, or without meaning to say something inappropriate. The situation was that our friend was very young, and so was her husband, and just out of the blue, she was just knocked out by a brain aneurysm. And we thought she'd get better, but she got worse and worse and worse and worse. And a longtime friend came in from out of town to see her at the point where she was virtually non-responsive. And she said, you know, oh, my God, I don't know if I can handle this.
And she said that to...
And she said it, unfortunately, to the husband who was at that time, who all along was the primary caregiver.
Right, and having a hard time handling it himself.
Of course. And it's an understandable reaction. I think we can all imagine, seeing someone who was... And Katie, the individual who got the brain aneurysm, was one of the most dynamic, outgoing, vivacious people you could imagine. So to see her in a bed, virtually non-responsive, paralyzed, was devastating to all of us. But the we I guess the take-home message there is that when we know, and we do know ahead of time, that we're going to be going to see someone who's in bad shape. So to prepare ourselves for that and to recognize that we can't be completely spontaneous about our reactions.
You need to be careful about what you say and who you say it to. You developed something that you call the ring theory as a guideline for people who are in this situation. And it's such a beautiful and simple illustration of how to cope with this. I think that's why so many people shared this on their Facebook pages and emailed this to friends and said, this is it. We've found the answer. Can you explain the ring theory for us?
Sure. Everyone has seen, you know, in a bar, or in their garage, or in their basement, everybody's seen a dartboard. So get that visual image. So you're going to essentially draw a circle, and what you're going to end up with is something like a dartboard. And in the center, at the bullseye, is the person who has had the trauma, whether it's you, whether it's your child, whether it's your spouse. So that's the name that goes in the very center. Now, the next ring is the person who is closest to that person. Whether it's, if there's a child in the center, then it's mom and dad. If it's the husband or wife in the center, then it's the other person, significant other. Beyond that, and then it changes in every dynamic because families and relationships are different, but let's next imagine siblings or grandparents or aunts and uncles, or, you know, in some communities, based on the relationships, it might be the very best friends. So we have a series of concentric circles, just like on a dartboard. And the key thing to remember is that the people closest to the middle can do and say, you know, within rules of civility, can do and say whatever they need to say to people in outer rings of the circle. But people in the outer rings of the circle ought to be very cautious and very mindful of what they say to people who are closer in. Because so those are the ones who are more profoundly affected by the trauma.
Right. So in the example that you shared earlier, when Katie had a brain aneurysm, her husband was caring for her. This friend came to see her and said to Katie's husband, "I wasn't prepared for this. I don't know if I can handle it." What she said was not wrong. That's a valid feeling that almost anybody who loved Katie would have had. The mistake that she made was in saying it to someone in a closer circle than she was. She dumped onto Pat, who was already carrying this huge burden, where she could have shared that with someone outside the circle and gotten her comfort from them. But you can't look inside the circle for comfort.
Exactly.
And you have the words, comfort in, dump out.
Right. We all ought to have those, you know, tattooed on on the palm of our hand when we're going to the hospital.
And I want to bring someone else into the conversation now. Again, I'm talking with clinical psychologist Susan Silk. She has both been a patient and a caregiver and someone who has loved people who have gone through difficult situations. I also want to bring Dr. Jim Bell into the conversation. He's medical director of palliative care and hospice at Unity Point St. Luke's in Cedar Rapids. Hello, Dr. Bell.
Good morning. Glad to be on with you.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And both you and Susan have had to deal with a lot of this kind of communication. And of course, in your line of work, you are communicating with patients yourself, you're communicating with the families of patients, and you're dealing with people who have chronic illnesses, in many cases, illnesses that cannot be treated, right?
That's right, and I haven't been on the receiving end of care as a patient myself, so most of my experience in that territory is from family members, but what I do all day is talk with patients and their families who are in those critical situations. That's right.
And when you talk with people about these critical situations, what are some of the guidelines that you would share for trying to have this communication when it comes to someone in your life who's very seriously ill?
Sure. So I've enjoyed listening to Dr. Silk's ring theory. I wasn't familiar with it before now, but it really is very much similar to what we do on a day-to-day basis, which is put the patient at the center of the circle here. And what we do, and you know, your paradigm here for talking is really very good, because it is what's the right thing to say, and maybe even more than that, what's the wrong thing to not say. And when I think about that, the filter that I always try to keep in mind is that this is about the patient. And what we tend to do is get our own issues, our own agendas, our own sort of baggage kind of in the way. And then what we say tends to come not from a bad motive, not from, you know, I think I'm going to try to be mean here or be inappropriate, but just from our own kind of life experiences or lack of those that lead us to say things that are, again, not poorly intended, but not really thinking through the eyes of the patient at that moment. And so when I talk, and a lot of the things that I say that are correct are on as a result of having said things the wrong way a whole bunch. So we just sort of learn from our day-to-day experiences what kind of things work and what kind of things don't work. But it really is when you think about those concentric rings. So when if I was to put that in my own language, it's about my family, okay, and it's about how to love each other. And so when I'm doing that, the best way to do it is to get myself out of the way.
And a lot of the things that sort of spring to our lips when someone is ill tend to be things that are not well thought through. And I honestly, I think that social media has really also given us an opportunity to say these things more often and possibly caused some problems because of that. A lot of people, when they hear that someone is sick, the first thing they want to do is offer comfort, and they want to say, it's all going to be okay.
Sure.
And in many ways, it's not going to be okay. What's wrong with saying that?
So again, what that automatically does is to sort of set up an expectation that may or may not be realistic. And if we want to be anything, we want to be realistic. And so, I hear people say all the time, he's a fighter. He wants to live. He wants everything done. She isn't going to give up. And so those, kind of phrases, are laced with implications that, again, are not poorly intended implications, but they may or may not be true. And so a lot of what we try to do when we unpack those phrases is to kind of try to understand what that implication is in terms of what's an okay way for you to live. Because to say that I'm not going to give up doesn't necessarily translate into I have to do everything that I possibly can to keep you alive, because it's not about giving up.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about communication when someone you love or you yourself has a serious illness. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about communicating about serious illness, communicating with people who have serious illnesses, and what we can do as friends and loved ones to care for people who have serious illnesses, and some of the very common mistakes that we make, however well-intentioned our actions might be. You're welcome to join our conversation this hour, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm talking with clinical psychologist Susan Silk. She has been on both sides of this equation as a caregiver and as a patient. She is a cancer survivor herself, and she developed the ring theory, which went viral a couple of years ago when she and her husband wrote an article for the Los Angeles Times. Dr. Jim Bell is also here, Medical Director of Palliative Care and Hospice at Unity Point St. Luke's in Cedar Rapids. And also on the line is Danette Hansen. She's a hospice and palliative nurse at Mercy Medical Center in Des Moines. Hello, Danette.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today. And you have a couple of examples of common mistakes that you see people making when they are communicating with somebody who is seriously ill. What are some of the things that you've seen?
Well, I certainly agree with the previous speakers about their examples of that. But I would also say that I think that there is a sense of fear, especially when patients are communicating with their families and their friends. it is difficult to share information about being very ill. And I think that we are afraid as family members and loved ones that if we discuss something, if we bring something up, that we're going to evoke fear, pain, anger, and we might have to deal with someone's grief. So avoiding that sometimes causes issues. Then we have, so to speak, the elephant in the room, and no one wants to talk about it. And in fact, that just causes more anxiety at times and more fear. And I think that's one of the biggest mistakes families can make with their loved ones and loved ones can make with their families. No one wants to say anything. And that just doesn't help get past some of the issues or to even be able to be loving and caring with someone.
So even if you say the wrong thing, it's better to say something?
Well, I think that you do have to be cognizant. I think people, like Dr. Bell said, I think people do mean the best. I think people do not go into it wanting to hurt each other. I think we have to be able to ask the right questions. And I think that's part of what palliative care does. We help patients, help families. How do I ask this question? How do I bring this up without hurting mom? How do I, as a patient, how do I tell my kids? And they do need help sometimes, and that's what we are here for. And so if you're finding it difficult to talk with your loved ones or your physician or your provider, ask someone for some assistance, because a lot of times we can give you some ideas and some clues. And then how to respond to those people that may have said the wrong thing and help them through. You know, it wasn't to be hurtful. They do care. They just sometimes don't know what to say.
Now, another thing that you have seen a lot, and, you know, when we're faced with an illness of someone that we love, we do want to fix it. We want to help.
Absolutely.
But something that you see often is people giving unsolicited advice.
Yes.
Tell me some of the things that you've seen.
I think that in our day and age, because we are so, it's just so easy to get a hold of information via the internet, any type of social media. And by social media, I don't just mean, you know, Facebook and those kinds of things. That could be the, you know, bingo parlor, your bowling team, your bridge club, a lot of information out there. And so when we become so desperate to find answers, to find a cure, to find something to fix, we tend to go out and seek that information. So here we are, you know, in an age where information is at our fingertips, and that's great. But I think that we need to make sure that we're helping people to get to reputable information. So you're surfing the internet, you know, making sure that you go to the National Institute of Health or Mayo Clinic or the Alzheimer's Association or the American Heart Association, because there are a lot of websites out there that have misinformation. And then your illness, maybe you have been sick, maybe you have a type of cancer, and so you want to give advice to your friend who now has maybe that similar type of cancer, but the two are completely different. Your situation is so individualized. And there is a lot of information out there, which is good, especially for people in rural areas that maybe not have access to so much. And consumers are becoming much smarter because of that information in magazines and newspapers. But I think sometimes what happens when we get to the point where we're really desperate, we tend to want to seek out information, the information that makes us feel good, that makes us feel like there is a cure, that something can change this disease process, and then we get ourselves in trouble trying to seek out information that may not be real accurate, but it sure makes us feel good.
So you're talking about a couple of different situations, because obviously if a patient is ill and they're seeking information, that's one thing. But if a patient is ill and they're seeking information, but they haven't asked you for information, you who are not an expert in this field, perhaps, and, you know, they have doctors, they have a lot of other resources at their disposal. If you haven't been asked for information, it sounds like you're saying you should not give it.
I think that, yes, I think as a friend, a family member, I think you have to be careful about the information that you are giving that is unsolicited. I would be very careful about that, because we all know that we can only accept information when we're ready to do so. So the family member or friend that may come, you know, maybe you're hospitalized and comes flying into the room and I know this, I know that. Here's a great person you can go to. I read this, I read that. And you may not be even ready to accept that information as a patient. who has just maybe received information about your illness. So people have to be ready to accept information, and they need to get honest, reputable information. And sometimes that whirlwind of people coming in because they want to be helpful indeed is not. They need to just step back, remember once again about the circle, the rings, that it is about the patient and not our own need to be fixers or controlling of our friends and families that may be ill.
Oh, Danette, thank you so much for being part of the conversation today.
Thank you so much.
Danette Hansen is a hospice nurse at Mercy Medical Center in Des Moines. And Susan, I heard you laugh when Danette was talking about giving advice. Is that something that you've seen a lot of?
Oh, man. You know, it comes from, as Danette said, and as Dr. Bell said, I mean, it comes from such a good place. I mean, we want to be helpful. But again, the receptivity of the person is so important, and also the idea that what we have to say may not be relevant, may not be accurate. But again, I think that with someone closer into the circle, we need to ask ourselves, you know, is this going to be comforting? Not is this true? It may be true, what you're saying. It may be correct. But is this going to provide comfort? And I think that's really critical. I think we want to bring into this conversation the notion of the very, very difficult role of the primary caregiver, so that very often we recognize that it would be inappropriate for us to, you know, give websites and phone numbers and make referrals information for the patient. We see that patient. We see them as vulnerable and compromised, so we tiptoe around that person. But unfortunately, sometimes we get this idea that we should take the husband, the wife, the mother, the father aside and say, well, you know, here's what you could do. And that's, again, that's very hurtful, and it's very overwhelming for the primary caregiver, who is, of course, in the position of doing everything that they can physically and psychically do to support the person who's ill.
In preparing for this show, I talked to a number of people who've been through experiences where someone that they loved has had a serious illness or a terminal illness. And one of the themes that kept coming up again and again is when someone finds out that, say, your father had lung cancer and died from it, people ask, oh, was he a smoker? So people want to assess blame for the illness.
Or, you know, think about this. Whenever anyone dies, what's the first question that when we hear that someone died, a friend, you know, if we're talking about we've just gone to a funeral or we're going to a funeral, people always ask, well, how old was the person? As though that mediates their emotional reaction. And just like in the case of, well, was he a smoker, there's kind of an implied judgment. And
right.
Again, how supportive is that for the person who's grieving?
Right. So what is your advice about asking questions? We have questions. That's something that immediately springs to your mind when you hear something.
Well, I think we can practice because who among us is not going to face this situation? So we can practice just like, you know, you teach children to say please and thank you and to wait their turn and to raise their hand. I think we can kind of brainwash, teach ourselves to say, I'm so sorry.
And save, keep your questions internal.
Keep your questions, well, two things, right? Keep them internal or direct them to someone who's further from the center of the circle.
Right. We're talking this hour about communicating with people who are ill, communicating about serious illness. With me, Susan Silk. She's a clinical psychologist and the creator of The Ring Theory. Dr. Jim Bell is here, medical director of palliative care and hospice at Unity Point St. Luke's in Cedar Rapids. We have a lot of people who want to join this conversation, so let's go to the phones. Carol is on the line in Knoxville. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Yes, I just heard one of your guests talking about expressing that they were sorry, and I've been hospitalized a couple of times because of an unfortunate surgical accident, and I had to go over my problem over and over with different healthcare providers that I was seeing in the hospital and out of the hospital, and very few of them expressed any sympathy. I mean, just not saying, I'm sorry that this happened to you. And that would have been very helpful for me. And I know they did the best they could for me, but it would have helped ease my grief about my situation if they had said, well, I'm sorry this happened to you, to know that they really cared about my distress.
Do you feel like they were not saying that because they were concerned about lawsuits and
no,
saying
no? No, I don't think so. I think that they were just seeing patient after patient and just kind of, it wasn't something they were accustomed to doing. No, I didn't feel that at all.
Oh, well, Carol, I'm sorry you've been through this. That sounds really difficult.
Well, I'm feeling a lot better now thanks to their good care.
Good.
But I just wish it would have helped me, my spirit, if they had said, if I had known that they saw my grief about my distress and just said, I'm sorry that happened to you.
Thank you so much for sharing this. I think that's really valuable for all of us who may not have been in that center circle to hear. Dr. Bell, can you respond to that?
Sure. So again, it's not, and to kind of rewind just a little bit, it's not that we shouldn't ask questions, and it's not that we shouldn't say, I'm sorry. It's that we should think about what we're really communicating. You know, probably 10 to 15% of our communication is our words. The rest of it is our body language and our inflection and what's really behind those words. So when somebody says, I'm sorry, they might not do that because they feel like I'm sorry means I'm sorry that somebody did something wrong, or I'm sorry that I made a mistake, when really what you want to hear is, I'm sorry that you're in this bad situation, and
right,
what's happening to you is you're suffering. And you're talking about anticipatory grief. And, you know, suffering is really the loss of wholeness. And so when somebody takes a chunk out of us and there's something missing, a way again for us to say, oh my gosh, I feel bad about that, is to say that I'm sorry. But we don't do it because it's awkward and it maybe tends to imply something that we don't want it to.
I think that just as human beings, when we're presented with a problem, we do want to look for solutions. That's something that we naturally just start doing. And we were talking earlier about giving unsolicited advice and looking for solutions where there may not be solutions. Obviously, we don't know what causes all forms of cancer. We don't know how to cure all forms of cancer. And if we did, that information would be out there. So if you go to someone with a surefire cure for cancer, chances are you don't have it. But when we're talking about our responses, Susan, do you have some advice for how to listen well to people without starting to offer solutions?
Well, sure. I think that we go in and we, you know, fluff up a pillow, we adjust the bed, perhaps we, you know, draw the curtain with, you know, if we're visiting a friend who's in the hospital or who's at home sick. And we ask, I think, an open-ended question. How are you doing? And I think one kind of trick that I have learned is that instead of asking, is there anything that you need, what can I do for you, we either show up with some chicken soup or a pot roast or a meatloaf or a new pillow, or we give them some specific things that we would be willing to do. You know, I'd really like to come over tomorrow and help your husband or wife clean up. Or I would really, how about I take the kids shopping? Or how about I, you know, give me a list, and, you know, one of you, somebody in the household, give me a list of the groceries that you need, and I'll make a run up to Costco. And then the other thing, in terms of addressing the other, letting the person know, which I think is so important, because sometimes people who are ill are afraid that if they really tell us how they're feeling, they're going to scare us away. So I think that we need to introduce that subject, and we need to give them permission to do that. Something open-ended, like, you know, this must be really hard. I'm really sorry. Do you feel like talking about it now? Or, you know, I want you to know that we can talk about how you're feeling if you'd like.
We have an email that addresses this subject. It's from Mary. She says, years ago, our daughter had serious trauma. We were shocked by acquaintances who called demanding information as if they were close to us and deserved to know. It hurt a lot. And that's, I think some of us are afraid to ask questions. Some of us are not afraid enough.
Exactly. That is so true. And, you know, that's where the friends getting together, people who are in the second or third circle out, can get together with one another and say, okay, how can we support the family? And in a case that in a family situation that I was involved with, one of the people, like you, Charity, was a journalist. And she was all about information and questions, but we all knew that the mother could not tolerate a barrage of questions.
And we'll talk more about that in just a moment. We have to take a short break. I'm talking with clinical psychologist Susan Silk and Dr. Jim Bell of Hospice Unity Point, St. Luke's in Cedar Rapids. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about communicating about serious illness, communicating with someone who has a serious illness, and how best to care, how best to express your concern and your care for these people. Dr. Susan Silk is here. She's a clinical psychologist, author of The Ring Theory, and Dr. Jim Bell, medical director of palliative care and hospice at Unity Point St. Luke's in Cedar Rapids. You're welcome to join the conversation as well with your experiences and your concerns. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Susan, before the break, we were talking about the dissemination of information. The fact that a lot of people want to know what's going on, people who don't necessarily have the right to ask questions want to know what's going on and may ask you anyway about something that's going on in your family. There are a lot of things that have been set up, the Care Bridge websites, that kind of thing, that give people an opportunity to send out that information and if somebody wants to know, they know where to go to get that information. But you were telling a story about a friend who was a journalist who had a lot of questions, and you knew that the person on the inside couldn't deal with all those questions.
But it was wonderful because the journalist was very, very close to the family and was very sensitive to their concerns. And the husband in that family, it was a daughter who was sick, and the mom was providing 24/7 bedside care. And the dad was running interference and doing some other things. And he also was a journalist, and he was very willing to disseminate the information to their friend who was a journalist, who, and I think this was probably before Caring Bridge existed, or at least before we knew about it, she put together a link to all of the people we all knew and all of the people who had the questions, and she organized that for them. So it was a perfect situation. She never intruded on the family in an inappropriate way, and her time with the family could be caring and supportive, but she provided a tremendous service at a time when mom and dad didn't have the energy or the inclination to do that. But by doing that, she could also say, okay, we've got, you know, baseball practice covered through Friday. Is anybody available for next week? Or we've got, you know, we've got a lot of lasagnas. How about a fresh green salad? And it was a terrific
way to communicate.
Terrific way to communicate. And all the friends loved the fact that they had something to do. People want to help. They care. They want to show their concern. And this gave them some concrete directions about how to do that.
Let's go to the phones. Marcia is on the line in Iowa City. Hello, Marcia.
So nice to speak with you again, Charity.
Yes, and what would you like to talk about today?
Oh, well, I had an experience last summer with some major surgery. And before I had the surgery, one sister told me, lots of people go through this. And then after the surgery, my sister, who said she'd help I called her for help 10 days into a 90-day recovery and asked her to bring me some Gatorade, and she couldn't find any. And when she got to my place, she told me, they're there now. Everything happens for a reason. And that implied judgment is just so crashing. It's wrong on so many levels. Family members mean the best. But, boy, you're right. They need to anticipate what they're going to say, anticipate the situation, and realize that they're just not at the middle of that target.
Oh, Marcia, thank you so much for sharing that experience with us.
I love this show. It's such a great topic.
Well,
I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. And I think that Marcia brings up a very important issue that is bigger than just what her sister said. But a lot of people bring their own religious beliefs into this conversation with people who are ill. And Dr. Bell, can you comment on that a little bit? We do hear people saying things like, you know, this is God's will, offering comfort when someone has died, saying, well, you know, he or she is with Jesus now, and this is good. And if that's not your belief, that's not very comforting.
Sure. So, again, when we have a family meeting and we have a conversation that really starts with what is the goal of the patient, and that's really where this should always sort of come back to is what is it about your situation here that speaks to us about how to best take care of you? So part of that is the medical decision making, and you guys have done a great job of talking about those things. Part of it is the interactions between the patient and their loved ones. So that is really, at its core, that's a spiritual connection. It's how we love each other. It's where we find our strength. It's where we find meaning and purpose in life. It's what happens to me after I die. It's what really matters to me. So those are spiritual things, but they're not necessarily religious things. And then we kind of put all of those things through our own filter, and we come at that with our life experience that says, oh, if you pray enough, oh, if you have enough faith, oh, if you believe the right way, then good things are going to happen to you. Okay. And if I tell you that, that doesn't come really from the core of your belief system, then what I'm doing is I'm just imposing my own reality kind of on your truth, and I can't do that. So you guys have already done a great job of kind of articulating that the place you have to start here is with those open-ended questions, and they need to be the right kinds of questions. So what I need to ask somebody is, where do you find your strength, and what is important to you, and what do you think is happening to you, and how is it that you want to live, and not tell you what I think is going to happen to you because I don't know.
I have someone that I'm very close to who had a very premature baby this year. The baby was born 23 weeks gestation, and, you know, 1 pound, 4 ounces, very, very scary situation. And the baby is doing extremely well. But as I've watched the situation from afar and watched it on social media, the things that people say, a lot of people will offer their religious conviction that everything is going to be okay.
Yeah.
And this is a very precarious situation. There's no way that anyone can promise that everything is going to be okay. That seems like if you are the person, if you're the mother or the father or someone very close to this situation, that seems like that could be a damaging thing to say.
Absolutely. Life-threatening situations in pediatrics or in beginning of life situations are some of the most difficult to deal with, and you're absolutely right. So that's absolutely thin ice to kind of be walking on anywhere. And again, it's not because we are not well-meaning, but it's because it's really awkward and uncomfortable and hard to ask those questions. And so sometimes especially again in medicine, we tend to talk way too much and not listen nearly enough. I think they've done medical studies that show that doctors interrupt patients within about 15 or 16 seconds of when they start to tell their story. And so what we're trained to do is fix things and give answers and give solutions to problems. And if we do that as family members too, again, we're robbing people of the opportunity to just tell us what's important to them. It always does start with the understanding of the dignity of a human life. And so, you know, we can get to these sort of common core things about being a human being that are sort of safe territory. And what I can say to you is, you know, you have choices in front of you. You have big issues in front of you. You have really hard things in front of you, but I care about you. And what I want to understand is what I can do to be part of good care for you.
Let's go to the phones again. Jackie is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Jackie.
Hi there.
Hi. What was your experience?
I had a full-term child years ago who ended up having severe health issues, and he was in the hospital for a month, and he came home on hospice. And a neighbor of mine said, "Well, you can have more kids, right?"
Oh.
Mm. And you know, my thought was, "Well, probably," but I want this one.
Right.
Mm. And as time went on, I'm incredibly grateful to say that he lived to be almost 12, and he was wonderful in the light of our life. But as he got sicker and sicker, and well-meaning people would say, well, maybe it's best, you know, if he passes away, it'll put him out of his misery. Like he's, you know, a pet or something. And it won't put me out of my misery. I mean, you know, and I'm a Christian, well-meaning Christian friends, you know, that meant well would say, well, you know, you're going to see him again. And yeah, but maybe not for 40 or 50 years. It's such a precarious thing. And, you know, well-meaning loved ones would say, maybe it's time for you to put him in a home, because it was full-time 24/7 for me. And I said, he has a home, and it's with me. And people, they mean well, I understand. But the last thing I wanted to say was that the worst thing, I personally, one of the worst things that I could hear was, I know. If I would try and reach out to someone or try and talk about how difficult it was to watch my beloved child suffer over and over and over, and I would tell them, I know. And no, you really don't. Unless your child has suffered, you know, you cannot even imagine. And after we lost him, it was still, you know, a lot of, I would try and talk about how bad the pain was and how much I missed him, and I know. Well, unless you've lost a child, you don't know. Oh. So those are just my thoughts.
Jackie, thank you so much for sharing that with us today.
Thank you.
I think that's a great comment that Jackie made there. And one of the things, so there are probably some things that you should never say, and one of them is, I know how you feel, because nobody ever knows how you feel. And it sounds like some very hurtful things came out, you know, in Jackie's experience there. And a big part of this, again, is that it's not poorly intentioned, but what we have to do then in our grieving process when those things come out is to think about forgiveness. And so there's forgiveness on both sides of the aisle, right? And part of my coping strategy in that grieving process is to learn how to forgive people who are hurtful to me without meaning to be.
Another theme that came up again and again as we were preparing for this show, and Dr. Bell, I think you probably have had experience with these situations, and I think this is something that Jackie probably experienced too. When someone is diagnosed as terminally ill, they often find themselves in the position of having to give comfort to other people who are sad about their illness and about their impending passing. Is that something that you see where the patient is put in this role?
Oh, sure. And there's a lot of tacit sort of things that happen that actually sometimes are even funny. I will stand outside rooms with families where the family will say, please don't go in and tell grandma that she's dying because she'll give up. And I'll go in and say to grandma, what's happening to you? And she'll say, I'm dying, but please don't go out and tell my family because they'll flip out. So, you know, sometimes you do, and I think Dr. Silk alluded to this, you need to call the elephant in the living room and just say, have the word die come out. And then, you know, let's just have a kind of a conversation around that, because it's, you know, dying is part of living. And it's if it's the truth of the situation, dancing around it isn't going to help anybody. And so sometimes, again, the best thing to do is not for us to sit and give a big, long soliloquy about what's happening. It's to just ask the patient that open-ended question, what do you think is happening to you? And they'll tell you. They'll say, I'm dying, and you guys all are going to need to just get into line here and deal with it. And that probably, more often than not, can just be a very healing thing. And as you just said, it comes from the patient. So we empower patients when we do that to just be part of that process, of caring the right way for them, and it's a good thing to do. And using humor, well-placed humor, is actually a very good tool also, and I'm sure Dr. Silk has some things to say about that.
Dr. Silk, did you want to add something to that? I also want to get one more phone call in before the end of the hour.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, Scott is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Scott.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I think we've all kind of touched on it in some tangent forms, but what I've experienced through countless visits with my wife, who's been in the hospital a lot, is that the best thing that I can do is just to simply acknowledge how she's feeling and try not to fix. I'm a fixer by nature. I think we all try to be, like you've said. So I found that to be incredibly valuable. And then second, excuse me, the other thing that's difficult with taking care of somebody that, you know, you're close to that inner circle is when others come in, they want to rehash. And that rehashing just kind of keeps opening that closure that you found over time. And I just wanted to kind of call that out and see what your experts on the line had to say about that as well.
That it's exhausting to talk about it again and again and again when you understand the situation. Scott, I'm so sorry you're going through this.
Thanks.
Susan, can you respond to that?
Sure. And again, we all know we're going to be at all those different, in every single ring. And when we're in an outer ring, I think that we ought to think, before we say anything, how will this help? You know, yes, this will not, and the answer is not how will it help me, but how will this help the family? If as in this gentleman's situation, he and his wife have just had a visit, and a friend or another family member comes by. Did the doctor come today? Did they change your medication? What's next? When are you going to be discharged? Not so helpful.
So what is helpful? I mean, I think that one of the things that I'm worried about this hour is that we've scared people. I mean, it's already scary to approach these situations.
Well, again, there are lots of things. I'm so sorry. Here's what I would like to do. I'll mow your lawn. Or how'd you sleep last night? Or I hope you sleep better.
Or what about, here's a funny story about my day.
You know, if you think, you know, the whole issue of here's a movie that I saw, you know, when you're feeling better, here's a, you know, bringing a library book or getting someone a book to read. As Dr. Bell alluded about, you know, the whole do we say death, do we say dying, it's really important to know that life and illness and even dying are not an event, they're a process. So there are two things about that. One is that we have to be present with the people all along. Mm-hmm. I mean, this isn't just a one-time thing that we say one thing. So sometimes it's going to be hand-holding. Sometimes it's going to be washing somebody's hair. Sometimes it's going to be sitting and watching a television program with them or reading the newspaper out loud. And another time it's going to be saying, if you're alone with the person, saying, you know, do you want to talk about what's going on?
We are out of time. But Susan Silk, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Susan Silk, clinical psychologist. We've put up an image of her ring theory on our Facebook page. You can find it there. And Dr. Jim Bell, thank you.
My pleasure.
Dr. Jim Bell, medical director of palliative care and hospice at Unity Point St. Luke's in Cedar Rapids. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbe.